ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot.
Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
I don't know, man, if it was easy to make money selling $27,000 cars, somebody would be successfully doing it.
There would be more of them. Hello and welcome back to the Plugged In Podcast, a weekly news show from Inside EVs all about the future of transportation. I'm Tim Levin.
And I'm Matt Hogan.
On this week's show, the EV sales numbers are rolling in for the first quarter, and we'll break down what's happened since the tax credit ended. Then in our lightning round, we'll discuss even more megawatt charging news from China, the rise of back to basics cars like the Slate and whether that can actually work for people, and what high gas prices are actually doing to EV sales around the world.
All right, let's get started. I think, Tim, why don't you lead us off with just the basics of what happened in Q1, who are the winners and losers of these EV numbers so far?
Yeah, I've been really interested. You know, I think we're going to come up with some takeaways as we talk through this. I've been thinking about the fact that, like, it's been 6 months since the tax credit ended. We had like a really weird Q4 where, you know, EV sales just like absolutely plummeted right after the tax credit ended. Now we're maybe coasting toward more of a kind of normal market, yeah, like as everything kind of shakes out.
Yeah.
So in
new
Q1,
normal, we should say.
Yeah, yeah, a new normal. I don't even know if that's necessarily true yet. I think we're still, mm-hmm, I think Q1 was still very much not normal. I think we're going to move towards something like more stable in the future.
Yep.
But so the numbers for Q1, as estimated by Cox Automotive, they say around 213,000 new EVs were sold in Q1 in the United States. That's down 28% year over year. So big drop from the pre-tax credit era. That represents about 5.8% market share, which is the same essentially as it was in the fourth quarter of last year. So new EV sales, quite far down, but also flat-ish quarter over quarter. One big bright spot that maybe we'll talk a little bit more about later on in the episode is the used EV market. This mm-hmm. is kind of following a completely different trajectory from new EVs. You also saw a big run-up in used EVs in the third quarter of last year as everybody rushed to get the used EV tax credit. But the drop-off has not been nearly as severe,
right,
as it was in the new market. So used EV sales up 12% year over year in Q1. Probably we're going to see even more growth this year as all these off-lease EVs hit the market again. So basically, that's kind of where the market is at in its totality right now. I think
we should
get into kind of how some of the different car companies did. We're not going to get into every single one of them, and also some actually haven't reported sales yet. But in general, it's like variations of down-ish, like flat. Some are flat, many are down.
The few weird exceptions. Everything's pretty much down. And I think the tax credit is obviously a big part of this. I do want to jump into it to explain. I think a very, very underappreciated factor in all of this too is the basically elimination of all emissions requirements in this country. You know, a year ago, it was like, if you want to sell a certain number of Silverados without blowing up your fleet average and having to pay fines on top of that, you have to sell the EVs to sort of counteract these things. And that balance, yes, you know, was driving this weird market where you had not only a $7,500 incentive, but then also you had a ton of incentive spending on top of that from automakers. I mean, I always point out my Blazer EV, it predicted the residual value on my lease would be like $44,000. The market value of my car is maybe $24,000 if you're, you know, generous right now at, you know, a couple months before the end of the lease. And so car companies were taking huge, I mean, that's a $20,000 write down on top of the all of the other stuff that was already there. So car companies were taking a huge hit on a lot of these EVs. The incentive to do that in the literal incentive game went away, and then the tax incentive also went away. So everyone's struggling. And I think for me, you know, what jumped out was just going through these numbers. I mean, there's a lot of bad numbers here, but the American companies, I think it's useful to see them as bellwethers of like where things are going. You have these three different companies that all have different levels of commitment to the EV market. And it's kind of interesting because regardless of what your strategy is, like everyone's down. So like overall GM sales are down like 9.7%, including gas cars. That's everything. But, you know, the EVs, they're up to 25,900 in Q1, slightly up from, you know, Q4, but down from Q1 2025, which makes sense. That's like the height of this bounce when Equinox and Blazer are popping off, when all the new Cadillacs are coming. Mm-hmm. But now we're in this weird sort of year two, year three moment where Cadillac, like everything was new last year. Chevy had a big push 2 years ago. And now we don't see quite as much movement on horizon. And, you know, Escalade IQ is down 26.8%. Lyriq down 21.6%. Optiq Cadillac is up 65%, so that's due. But Blazer EV is like off the map. It's now down 82.6%. And the Equinox is doing well. It had, you know, about 10,000 units, but it's down 7.2%, even though they had a ton of incentive spending on this, right? And to me, yeah, that dichotomy between Blazer and Equinox is really what's interesting, because Equinox, they've been still heavily incentivizing. I've seen people getting them for like $25,000, and it's still holding up. The Blazer, they have not put nearly as much effort into, and the results are showing. I mean, down 83%, that's really tough. Meanwhile, over at Ford, you know, EV sales are down 69.6%. You would think that most of that's Lightning, but it's not. I mean, Lightning is down like over 70%. But Mach-E, which has always been the volume seller, is down 60.4%. And then, so they're in a weird spot where...
Yeah, Mach-E is down from over 11,000 units Q1 of last year to under 5,000 in Q1 of this year.
Right. And I mean, that's their only EV. And it, you know, came out in 2021 and it wasn't particularly cutting edge back then. I mean, it took till 2024 for them to even add a heat pump, I think. So that's an interesting situation for them to be in, where Lightning's gone, Mach-E is the only thing holding it together, and they're sort of waiting for the universal EV platform stuff to come, which isn't going to come till next year. So you're not going to see much movement from Ford unless it's just they decide to heavily incentivize Mach-E. But if, you know, things look tough at Ford, a lot more going on there than Stellantis. I mean, they've always gotten flack for not having a super strong EV game, but now they went from like, you know, back of the pack to not even near the pack. All combined, their three EV models, the Jeep Wagoneer S, the Dodge Charger EV, and the Fiat 500e, sum to less than 500 units. So maybe they might have to rename that Fiat. But like, you know, and also, I mean, they were down from already really low bases, but they're also all down over 80%. So Fiat 500e is down 85% to 68 units. Charger EV is down 88% to 240 units. And Wagoneer S is down 93% to 175 units. Those are cars that are only a year or two old. So it's just, it's a bleak time over there.
Yeah, I think it's really complicated. Like, I think the factors are, there are many factors and they're actually kind of complicated, and I think more complicated than most of the coverage makes it look. Like, I think you see a lot of articles that will say, you know, as consumer demand wanes because of the end of the EV tax credit, like EV sales are going down. And it's like, I think that that Stellantis is kind of a perfect example of how that's like not the full story. I think a big part of it is, yes, EV tax credit goes away, effective prices go up by $7,500. That automatically drops the number of people who are willing to pay that much money, right? That itself is going to deal a big blow to EV sales.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
I think another part of it is on the manufacturer side. Like, I think, you know, you talked about incentives and that kind of thing. I think it depends a lot on if you're a manufacturer that cares enough or wants to incentivize things, you know, wants to add some money on the hood to take care of the end of the tax credit, or is just dropping prices, you know, dropping MSRPs. And it also depends on, like, how many of these you want to sell, because there was the EV tax credit that was pushing things. And then there also was, as you mentioned, the regulations. So, like, you don't need to, if you're, and we've talked about this, like, maybe ad nauseum, but I think it's worth hammering home, is like, if you're a car company, you just don't need to, nobody's telling you to sell as many EVs as they were before. You don't need the fuel economy credits to offset your gas guzzlers and that kind of thing. So, like, when I look at Stellantis EV sales, yeah, these cars are not great. So I think it's possible that, you know, pure demand is also part of it. Like, people have other choices. Maybe they're not going for the Wagoneer S. But is it really that there's only 175 people in the entire country who wanted to buy a Wagoneer S in Q1? Or is it that Jeep, like, doesn't feel, you know, they didn't add the incentives. They don't really feel like... Well, putting their weight behind that in the same way that another company feels like, you know, in, from a strategy perspective, putting their weight behind a different model.
I don't know. I want to push back on that, because I think it, the logic kind of gets circular to the point of, like, okay, well, nobody's forcing them to make these products, right? Well, no one's forcing them to make Ram 1500s or Chevy Silverados, right? They're making them because they make money. And right now, like, you know, a year ago, Ford didn't even in their, you know, release really talk about Model E, the electric vehicle unit. But, you know, it was like, all right, we're losing a bunch of money, but we're growing towards the future. And they were losing a bunch of money when there were $7,500 from the federal government. You know, car companies, they're very profitable companies, but they're not, car companies are not frequently banking so much margin that, like, $7,500 they can write down, and that it's like not. I mean, obviously, there's huge incentive programs. Sometimes you build incentives into the pricing. But fundamentally, like, I agree with you, there are more than, you know, 200 people or whatever that want a Jeep EV, right? But the question isn't who wants a Jeep EV. The question is who wants a Jeep EV and will pay what it costs to
at
get
the price.
One.
Right.
And I don't think, I think it is a demand issue. You know, it's like it used to, it's the opposite of where, you know, it used to be artificially we were creating demand through both the fuel economy regulations and the tax credit, right? Neither of those things exist anymore. So what I would say right now is more a natural supply point matching a more natural demand point. I don't think that's good for our climate. I don't think that's good for the long term, but I think that's the truth. And I think it also helps me understand a little more some of these companies' EV pullbacks when you look at, like, oh man, like, Equinox is struggling to stay afloat and they are throwing money at it, you know? And then I'm looking at a Honda data. Prologue is down 65.3%. Now, is it a coincidence that 2 weeks ago or a week ago or whenever they announced that the Prologue, they're cutting the price by $7,500 exactly, right? Because they're like, all right, we had a model for how much this thing costs. And by the way, again, Prologue heavily incentivized even when there was a tax credit, right?
Yeah.
Probably will still be incentivized at this price. And we're just running into this problem of, like, all right, well, if you have to sell it for $10,000 or $12,000 or $13,000 less than it costs to build, then, like, you do have a demand problem.
Totally.
Where is that root coming from? Is it that, you know, people have been marketing towards these cars? You know, I think you're right. There's definitely a part of it where it's like these companies aren't really pushing them even outside of the incentive structure, right? Like, I always say the biggest structural problem for any of these companies is ultimately they can't tell you, oh, you should buy a Mach-E because it's better than a gas crossover, because they still want to sell you a gas crossover, right? Like, it makes them more money to do that. And so we're just stuck. There's a messaging problem that was partially offset by these incentives and these restrictions. And now that's all gone. And now there's just the messaging problem left.
Yeah. I think it's just, I just think it's important to note that, like, it's a two-way street. Like, yeah. I think the car companies want you to think it's in their interest to say things like, oh, we're just following consumer demand. We're just building what the people want. And it's like, no, they have their own reasons for incentivizing things, for building more, for building mm-hmm. less of certain models.
Right, but the reason is making money. And you're saying, yeah. well, they should just incentivize it anyways and make less money. And no, I'm not agree for the long term, right? But like, yeah. there's a reason
I'm not saying they should.
It.
I'm just yeah. saying it's within their power. That's part of why you see such a big difference in some of these numbers is because of the manufacturer deciding it's within right. their power to, you know, pull the levers and have sales be higher or lower.
Yeah. And I mean, to zoom out even further, right? Like part of Tesla's whole magic is they've convinced Wall Street that they're a tech company, right? And like that yeah. means infinite growth and all these other things. But another part of the tech company story, you see it with Amazon, you see it with all these companies, is you burn money for some years to control market share. And then once you have a giant share of the market, then you can use your, you know, scale to start increasing your profit margins, things like that. And these car companies aren't really built like that. They're built for just, you know, like we need to make money today, and they are, you know, more profit driven than growth driven. And I think that's something they need to figure out, because I think it is a choice they're making. They're prioritizing gas cars, and it's like, yes, it is the more profitable move now, but somebody is going to own that market in the future, right? And mm-hmm. some of these companies are serious about it. I would put GM in that category, and then some kind of aren't, like Stellantis. And then a weird turnaround story. Tim, this was your story. I want to kick to you, but who's the big winner this quarter?
Yeah. Yeah, we talked a little bit about it last week, but Toyota, the BZ, up 139.5% in yeah. Q1. So more than double sales to over 10,000 units. They beat the Equinox, the Mach-E, the Ioniq 5, kind of all the mm-hmm. all the usual suspects of the really high selling non-Tesla EVs. Part of that, a big part of that, was Toyota was putting on kind of heavy incentives. They clearly, like, after years of being sort of on the sidelines or sort of behind, they mm-hmm. want to grab some share while they can.
Yeah.
But I think it points to, like, I mean, I'm curious what you think, but when we look at kind of the cars that are succeeding, Toyota BZ, over 10,000, the Hyundai Ioniq 5 also was up year over year, mm-hmm. Close to 10,000 units in Q1, 9,800 units in Q1, despite the fact that, like, the Ioniq 6 is on its way. Like, the Ioniq 6 was basically not really a factor this quarter. Yeah. It's on its way out.
Barely a factor when it was. I mean,
yeah, that was in like the hundreds. And then we have the one you mentioned, the Equinox. Like, it's kind of the same. It's some of the same ones as last year, still doing well. I think part of its incentives, which creates its incentives on the BZ, it's with the Ioniq 5. They just right after the tax credit went away,
yeah,
they dropped the MSRP of that by, I think it was up to like over 9,800 bucks.
And it was all so like that, 7 to 9. I mean, it was, yeah, across the
yeah,
board.
Yeah, entry level Ioniq 5 is 35 grand. And so it's kind of these ones that, like, they nail that price and, like, value, you know, these are cars that are just like at the prices that the companies are deciding to sell them for. They're a pretty good value.
Yeah.
And they're still selling pretty well.
Yeah. And I think that's something that car companies are starting to learn too, of like, they all priced MSRPs at like what they would like to sell it for. And there's clearly been a disconnect between that and what the consumer will pay. And I think Honda and Hyundai's moves show that they're like, all right, well, if we're going to end up taking 7 grand off everyone we sell, nobody yeah. wants to buy something marked 25% off because it looks like it's last year's style, right? And so I think it is smart to just say, this is the price. The price is the normal price. Don't have to rely on dealer games or anything. And then, you know, if you transact above that, then you can raise the price next year. But like, mm-hmm. you don't, if you're putting 10 grand on the hood of a vehicle that just got redesigned, it's like, well, how attractive does that look? And I wanted to bring up the redesign factor, because I think that also really plays in here. You know, I'm coming up to the end of my lease and I'm looking at, all right, what can I get? You know, what's out there in the market? And the answer is pretty much the same options that when I got my lease 2 years ago. It's like, all right, do you want an Equinox, a Mach-E, a Model Y, an Ioniq 5, an EV6, or Blade, like,
yeah.
And, you know, later this year, we're going to see more stuff coming. We're going to see R2 arriving. We're going to see, you know, maybe another Lucid. We're going to see the Slate truck. We're going to see all these new Mercedes and BMWs.
Trail Seeker. You're going to get a Trail Seeker, aren't you?
Yeah, no. But yeah, then like all of those new Toyotas and Subarus are not on the charts yet, or they are, but not in meaningful numbers yet.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of it too, is just that like, you know, people do not understand. They're used to like phone update cycles where like the new thing changes every year. And like car companies, like you come out with a model, you keep it on sale for 5 to 6 years and then you update it. So even if you're looking at a whole class, you know, most of the players in the class are not going to be the top, the best call. And then, so like how often is there a new benchmark for the class? Every 2 to 3 to 5 years, you know? And a lot of these cars like Mach-E, Ioniq 5, ID4, they all date to like 2021, you know? And they're still very competitive because fundamentally the EV experience is better than the gas experience, just in terms of, you know, smoothness and speed and all that stuff. But I do think that's a big thing factoring in, is because we're sort of, 2024 wasn't a super bullish year for EVs for these companies yet. 2025 was worse, and now they're all hunkering down for 2026. But then you look at 27 and you start to see like, oh, okay, GM is going to start introducing its next gen stuff. Ford is, you know, more of that stuff is going to trickle down. But this year is already just sort of feeling like a hold out, wait and see year, which isn't the most exciting, you know, takeaway, but it's like, it seems to be what the numbers are showing me.
Yeah, no, I think it's like, you know, from the people I talk to, you know, it's kind of like we're waiting. The car companies are figuring out what mm-hmm. the like quote unquote natural demand is, right?
Yeah.
Like they're very much rejiggering their plans. And it's like maybe later in the year they'll realize, okay, we pulled back too much. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can actually be a little bit more aggressive. So I don't think it'll necessarily be the exact way it is right now for the whole year.
Right, and they can also drive down costs, right? Like more scale, right. More, you know, improve Mach-E. I mean, for all of the, you know, ways that car hasn't been perfect throughout its time, they've driven out a lot of costs of that platform. Now, some of that has been just directly they're taking a bigger loss on certain things. But no, they've simplified a lot of parts. They've removed a lot of things. And I think car companies, like that's why this Ford UEV platform is a big deal. Like companies are catching on to the idea that like the Tesla model, it's not just about making great EVs. It's about using a software-defined vehicle with a very minimalist interior to cut down all of these costs. Because frankly, they're the only ones that are posting crazy high volumes and still making money on these cars because they found the formula. You know, they made it work. And I think there's a lot of cost. Yeah, I just think about the fact that my car is like 800 pounds heavier than a Model Y. And it's like, all right, well, all that material has to come from somewhere. And all of those interconnections and everything costs money in a car. Interestingly, one other, you know, takeaway as I'm looking at all of this too is like, okay, so Lightning is gone. There's still some holdover sales, but Lightning, the number one seller in the segment, is canceled. And you would kind of expect that that would lead to a bump on the other cars on the platform. Now, Tesla and Rivian don't break out specific Cybertruck or R1T sales versus R1S. R1 sales overall are up 20%, so Rivian might have gotten something from there, but only up to 10,000. So, it's not a crazy high number. Cybertruck, we don't know, but I will say the GM trucks, you know, the GMC Sierra is up 3.1%, but that almost definitely doesn't make up for the fact that Hummer's down 52.5% and Silverado EV is down 41% after a year where they had some new trims and, you know, put a lot of push behind it. And so it's interesting to see there's just still just that fundamental weakness in the you know, large truck segment for EVs. And that's a place where it's like, yeah, we need these new blood ideas. We need the new Ram EREV. We need the Scout to arrive, although that's been delayed. We need this Ford truck. We need just some new concepts and new ideas, because I think a lot of the trouble with the EV market now is a lot of this was based on the idea that, number one, the credits would hold, and number two, the costs would come down more quickly than they have. And so it's like, if you have a car, you know, like a Cadillac Lyriq or something, like, and you need, or that's a bad example because I'm talking mostly in the mainstream segment, but you have something like an ID4 and you want to pull $5,000 out of the cost of building that without making a heavily compromised product that people aren't going to want, like, you just can't really do that without a clean sheet redesign. And I think advancements in battery chemistry, advancements in design, all of these things are happening behind the scenes. When you talk to executives, you talk to people at car companies, they're working very hard on this. But I don't know how much cheaper they can make the cars that already exist at this point without just burning their own money.
Yeah. Yeah. And like maybe they, you know, there are reasons to want to do that. Like if you want to keep building scale, to drive
EV
down those
buyers
costs
very loyal.
Yeah. You want to get buyers, you want to get share and hold on to it. Yeah. One that we haven't talked about yet that kind of disappointed me was the Nissan Leaf. This is down. So like new Nissan Leaf was introduced sometime late last year.
October or something was when they started getting delivered.
So in Q1, Leaf sales down over 70%. And that's as compared with the old Leaf selling last year. So there were only 668 new Leafs sold in the first few months of this year. And like for an EV that we and everybody like that we hailed as and still think is a really good little car and it's good price. It's just not a significant player right now. And
as we joked, like about that. You've never seen one on the road. I've seen one.
I've never seen one. Yeah.
And you live in the Bay Area and I live in Southern California. I would say the two primary markets for EVs in this country. So that's not a great sign. I will say, obviously, on the affordable front, like these are the cars that are most affected by the loss of the tax credit, although notably the Leaf would not have gotten the tax credit unless you leased it, right? Which, God, it feels like so long ago that I've had to say that. And it arrived like
it's not made in America.
And it arrived right after the tax credit ended, which I think is like, not only is that bad in terms of obviously it didn't get to take away from the tax credit, but a brand new model from a company that doesn't have a ton of like brand leverage right now, doesn't have a ton of, I wouldn't imagine, marketing money behind it. Like your first couple months on the market are like very important. And when you arrive at a time where the entire EV market is collapsing,
it's tough. Vibes were terrible.
Vibes are tough. Also an import tariff, who knows? But yeah, I think this is a, you know, we have, when we were debating whether to give this, you know, award, our Breakthrough EV of the Year award to the Leaf, you know, one thing Patrick George had said, it's like, are these $30,000 ones actually going to exist? Because we've been burned by that a lot in the past.
Yeah.
Just like car companies say they want to do this, but then they either like the $20,000 Ford Maverick wasn't really on dealer lots. And then it was for a little bit, but then they changed the price and blah, 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 blah. You know, sometimes they sort of get you in the door with that. But I don't know. Yeah, I think Leaf is, I would say, maybe the best example of where we might be seeing a little bit of intentional choice by the car company of like...
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, Nissan is sort of in survival mode. They did post for their quarterly results that they're the fastest growing brand in the US right now. I think they're really, really trying to, like, when I talked to their executives this time last year, they're like, yeah, we are really focused on Rogue and Pathfinder and just the things that make us money. And when they were saying that at a time when they were just introducing the Leaf, or, you know, we were looking at a prototype of the Leaf, it was like, all right, well, how does small front wheel drive EV and things that make us money combine? And I think the answer is 668 units a quarter.
they have said exactly this. Like they had one of their executives talking, I think, to Automotive News last year around the time when the Leaf was launching. And they were like basically telegraphing this exact move. They were like, we're going to focus on California and kind of some of the places where EVs sell. And they weren't positioning it like this is going to be, you know, we're going to take over the market with this affordable little crossover. And that's another thing we talked about during the Breakthrough Awards. We were like, are we going to, like, should we give this award to a car that like they don't seem like they're exactly trying to sell as many as they can. So yeah, I think that's an example of like, I don't know. I don't want to cross over into like EV advocate mode. But just sometimes you see like I don't think that's a good example of, oh, people, well, look, Nissan brought out this affordable EV and it's not selling well. It's like, well, there's actually other things besides you know, how many people actually want that $30,000 EV. It's how much are they deciding to push it?
Well, in the same way with the Bolt, right? Where it's coming out and there's some sales showing, but they've already canceled it. It's like part of it is these car companies' business model. Like the reason $50,000, like I wrote this story a couple of years ago on why no one wants to sell you a $25,000 EV. And the long and short of it is no one really wants to sell you a $25,000 car because in this era where most of the cost is the design and the certification and then the warranty and recalls and all those other things, like the difference between selling you a $25,000 car and a $60,000 car, the process of doing that is not all that easier. The main difference is $35,000, you know? Like, it's just much easier to find ways to pad margins there. And when you look at, you know, one thing that struck me when I went to the Leaf first drive is, like, the average Leaf buyer is pulling down between, I think it was, like, between $115,000 and $150,000 a year. And when you think about that in the context of this is the most affordable EV on sale, predominantly car companies in this country cater to people in their 50s and 60s that have household incomes far in excess of $200,000 or, you know, plenty of money saved. And I think that's just a really useful thing to remember as to why these companies aren't pushing the affordable EVs. Now, there's the cynical argument, which is, well, why does Chevy want you to buy a Bolt when they could upsell you into an Equinox with Super Cruise and okay, it starts at 35, but really you're going to pay 47, whatever. And then there's a practical argument, which is that, like, I don't know, man, if it was easy to make money selling $27,000 cars, somebody would be successfully doing it.
There would be more of them. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Sure. And I think, again, like an example I always come back to is the Ford Maverick, because I think that is the closest thing we've had in the past 10 years, even to a affordable product that felt aspirational, that people were excited for, that there was a waiting list for. Mm-hmm. And even that, very quickly, they ratcheted up the price. And even when the low price model did exist, it's like, you know, that when people talk about, oh, you know, the Slate's going to have to compete with a $28,000 Maverick, which has all the stuff you want on it. It's like, well, the $28,000 Maverick is not the one people are buying. That's the XL with the steel wheels. And it looks like a, you know, rental car. And it's the one I like the best. I think it looks really
cool. I like the steel wheels. But no, yeah, I do too.
But like,
I drove the... I remember I tested when it first came out, and it was 19.995 or whatever.
Yeah.
I think it didn't even have, it didn't have basic cruise control, I don't think, much less adaptive. It had like manual. I was like, where the hell is the like little button to adjust my mirrors? Oh no, you actually have to reach your hand out and like poke the mirror and move it. Like this is the kind of stuff that people are not used, most people are not used to in their cars at
and
this point.
And if you, in the dealer, they notice that. You know, the salesman goes, oh, yeah, I mean, if you want all the stuff, you want the XLT. And then they get in the XLT and they're like, man, I kind of want my seats to be cooled. You know, like it is as much us as it is the manufacturers. And part of it is, again, most of the way people learn about cars in America, right, is like through marketing or, you know, and so you're taught to want certain things, like how in 1992, somehow most people in the country were totally fine without all-wheel drive. And now everyone on earth needs all-wheel drive. And it's like, well, the climate, well, it did change, but mostly for the hotter. And it's mostly driven by consumer preference of we want more than, you know, we necessarily need. And generally speaking, there are enough buyers willing to pay extra that chasing the buyers that are chasing the lowest end buyers is like, all right, now you're chasing the people who are going to nickel and dime you over everything. And so I think it's just a weird place for EVs specifically, because it's hard enough to make a cheap car. And then making cheap EV, it's like, you got to remove all this stuff. And, I think unless there's more to say on the EV sales front, this would be a good transition into our next point, our lightning round about, you know, where that line is.
I think quickly we should first, though, we haven't talked about Tesla, which,
that is
spoiler alert, does sell like a half of the EVs in America.
What's that company? Never heard of it.
Tesla? Is that how it's called? So we don't have yet the U.S. estimates that we usually get because Tesla doesn't break those out, but we should quickly just run through what Tesla announced. They delivered 358,000 EVs globally in Q1. That's up 6.5%. The thing that I would add is like it's up 6.5% from a kind of shitty quarter last year. Q1 of 2025 was when there were Tesla takedown protests, and they were, admittedly, they themselves said that You know, we're changing over Model Y production lines around the world, and so sales are a little bit slower.
Well, and the global numbers specific. I mean, even outside of that takedown protests here, yeah. which were, you know, there were some dip. I mean, Europe and Korea and all these other markets completely revolted against the company during
yeah,
that time.
It was yeah. It was a crater. It was a terrible quarter for Tesla. Yeah. So up is okay, but that was one of its worst quarters in years. The other thing that I'd note, and then I'll ask, and then you can jump in, is like the more affordable models have, I think, mostly just allowed Tesla to keep kind of coasting flat, which mm-hmm. in a way makes sense because at least in this market, you know, you cut the price of the Model Y and the Model 3, but the tax credit went away. So net, the entry price for a Tesla didn't actually change that yeah. much. So yeah, it's just not, you know, I think about where Tesla might be if those more affordable models were something actually different and actually a lot cheaper. It might be we might have actually seen a stronger quarter.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Yeah, I mean, so two thoughts on that. First off, 358,000 EVs. I think just that number is also just a reminder. Like, I don't know. I'm pretty sure Toyota has not built that many EVs total, the whole history.
Probably not.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I just did a quick search on it. I don't know. But it's just a reminder. So many companies can't deliver that in 5 years, let alone. So it's still crazy. And they are still absolutely at the top of the heap. I think what you're saying about affordability is true. This was a conversation you and I had about like the MacBook Neo and this concept of, yeah. oh, like they were able to take this premium brand and cut the price by 40% and deliver a product that people are still excited about. Why can't Tesla kind of do that? And I think like for all of the flack Elon has gotten for canceling the Model 2, right? And to focus on the robotaxi stuff, I don't know the economics of whether or not that was a good decision. What I can tell you is that I don't know how you could possibly make the Model 3 cheaper in a meaningful way without a technological breakthrough or a whole new line that would then necessitate, like, the reason these are so much cheaper, right? The reason there's, like, you know, a glass roof on the Model Y that's covered by a headliner is because the process of changing the stamping robot over between one that puts, you know, glass there and one that forms a new piece is more expensive than just giving you the glass and covering it up. And I think that's something people still do not understand about car making. Like, there's a reason mm-hmm. Tesla only offers a few configurations and a few colors, because variety is extraordinarily expensive in car making. I mean, it's why only Porsche will give you the level of like granular optionality that people might want. And I don't know how Tesla could possibly make something cheaper without compromising on range, which buyers don't really want, or compromising on size, which I don't think buyers want either.
Yeah, I don't even think it needs to. I wouldn't even say it needs to be meaning like that much cheaper. It could even be somewhere in between. It could be like a Model Y Plus that is like an off-roady version. You know, they have room for to make other cars. Like they
yeah,
only make
just
two
to make
cars.
Interesting stuff. Like you know, beyond okay, you've done Plaid, you've done Performance. So yeah, is there some rally sport Cybertruck? Is there some you know, special edition? I think that's something that. But again, I think that's something that goes against their model, which is simplicity, scale. Beats everything, right? Like mm-hmm. BMW does a million different variations of everything, but then, you know, it imposes a cost on every unit to have that flexibility. So I don't know what Tesla could have possibly done to make these any cheaper, because they've removed so much that I wouldn't give up anyways. Like, I would still tell people to just get the Model Y Premium. And that is the good transition Probably. Into our next topic, which was something that the Dodge CEO said recently about, you know, they want to make more affordable cars too. And he was saying like, all right, like we need people to maybe rethink their expectations here. Like, do you really need a radio, or can this just be sort of a Bluetooth situation where your phone controls everything? And that's obviously something we've seen from Slate, at, you know, in in Tesla or in the cheap Teslas, they didn't remove the radio in terms of the display, but they did remove AM radio. And I believe in a bunch of other
little... removed FM radio.
Oh, FM radio. AM radio was already gone. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's, we're just at this really interesting point where they're like, car companies are recognizing all these things that we're talking about. And I'm late to it of this idea that like, there's just not that much fat on a normal car, right? Like all of these things that we think of that have been added that cost a lot of money, like the screens, people say cars are expensive because of the screens. It's the absolute opposite of the truth, right? That screens replace a bunch of separate buttons that all need their own SKUs and need to be fitted correctly and need to be watertight and sealed and easy to replace and all that other stuff. And you could just put one giant LCD there and it costs you $20. And then the software cost is distributed across all of these. But yeah, this Dodge, you know, question was like, he said, I think the biggest thing is that we need to start doing is challenging the industry on what the expectations are from an entry level base vehicle. And I don't mean that from the word cheap or less. I mean that from the back to basics. Analog gauges. Do you need a radio? Do you just have speakers that you Bluetooth through? We need to push forward and maybe make people uncomfortable, but give them something they don't realize they want. And that give them something they don't realize they want, I think is really the operative thing here, because that's the big question I have with Slate, the question I have with the Bolt or the Leaf. These are the vehicles that are most affordable, that are solving the problem of transportation for the lowest. And if you, you know, remove emotions and desires from it, that should be the right answer. But giving someone something they don't realize they want, that's easy to do when you're offering them more than what they thought of, right? Like Steve Jobs, or, you know, famously didn't care about, or this old quote that's attributed to Henry Ford. I don't know if it's truly from Henry Ford. If I asked people what they wanted, they would have said faster horses. But there is that feeling of like, to truly innovate, you need to go beyond what people tell you, right? You can't focus group your way to innovation. But if the innovation is giving them less than they say they want, I don't know how you market that. I don't know how you sell that. I mean, do you think there's a world for Dodges without radios? I don't know.
Because I my immediate reaction is like, was going to be like, well, you know, people didn't know that they wanted to buy F-150s and just drive them to and from the grocery store all the time, or, you know, that they needed like Yukons and, but now people do.
But if you asked an American 20 years ago, what do you want from your car? They'd say, I want a bigger one.
Right. Like, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I think you're totally right that it's a lot easier to sell people on something they didn't know they wanted when it's like bigger and better.
Yeah.
Something just that's just cheaper and less. I don't know. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how the Slate does. And if Dodge does something like this, like affordability is such a big thing. The monthly car payments are getting like absolutely out of control. Mm-hmm. It's I don't have them in front of me, but it's depressing to see what people are paying and how long they're paying it for. It is unbelievable.
Yeah.
So
how many of them are underwater?
Yeah. Like obviously it would be a better financial decision for a lot of car buyers to buy something that's simpler and cheaper versus something that is giving you like a $700 loan for 84 months.
Yeah.
But whether that works, it'll be really, I think it will come down to the marketing of like, how does Dodge decide to sell that?
Yeah, and how do you make it
appealing?
Like, yeah. Would you rather have just like a 2-year-old car that does have a radio? I don't know. I genuinely don't know the answer to that, right?
I would.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's so interesting because I love old cars and I like the simplicity of them. I love the idea of like, you know, one thing that when I found out the Slate is going to have a double DIN radio slot, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's awesome. Like, you know, the right size for that. Because now, if I ever wanted to upgrade the radio on the Blazer, forget about it. You can't touch it. You know, it's all locked down. And I think there is something to be said of the more, like specifically in America, because you look at Chinese EVs, they're just offering you more for less. I mean, they have the economics to do that, whatever. But I also think American buyers specifically, and I don't know how much of this is me living in this bubble of like super enthusiast people who are excited to talk about it on Reddit or on social media forums or when I worked at Road and Track, whatever. But I do think there's a very sizable amount of people who are frustrated at the feeling that the cars are getting so impossible to work on, so hard to fix, so complicated that they can't understand. Not only do they not know how to fix things, but they don't even know what to worry about, what will break. You know, I get people who are like, oh, what's going to happen to the screen in 10 years? Like, I've owned 20-year-old cars with screens, and the screens are not the problem. But dead buttons on the radio absolutely are a problem on a 20-year-old. So I don't know what is going to be reliable or unreliable in the long term. But the idea that I can't even see my way to fixing any of this, I think is a real marketing opportunity. But you have to actually deliver on that, and we'll see if they can do that.
I'm gonna move our lightning round along because it's not
wasn't very lightning,
not super lightning right now.
Me talking too much, weird.
I brought a story which is kind of a counterpoint to what we saw with U.S. EV sales. In the UK, EV sales hit a record in March, so things are looking very different outside of the U.S. Mm-hmm. This was according to a Bloomberg report citing like official UK stats. 86,000 electric vehicles, battery electric vehicles, were sold in 1 month in March. And maybe they speculate this could have something to do with rising gas prices, right? Like, this is also hitting, this is not just an American problem. Like, this is hitting other parts of the world. And you're seeing in places that have really strong EV markets, like the UK, people are turning to EVs.
Yeah, and notably, I'll add in two factors that may increase the gas price part of it. Now, I don't know if this part transfers internationally, but I know for a fact in the US, diesel is accelerating. It's gotten way more expensive than gasoline. I believe that is true on the international markets, though I'd have to double check that. But UK is a heavily diesel market for, you know, passenger vehicles. So that's one factor. And the other factor is, in general, gas prices in the rest of the world were already higher, right? So like in the US, even with our super high gas prices, we're probably still paying less than people in the UK were paying in, you know, January or whatever. That's when the math starts to actually tip in, because for most American consumers, I'd say, well, you should get an EV, but maybe not for this reason. For UK consumers, it might be a totally different story. And it's just a good reminder that the world is going to electrify with or without us.
Yeah. And the UK has, they have more incentives for buyers. Yeah. They also have Chinese cars that are imported there and selling super well, like these MG SUVs. So that they're doing things quite a bit different than us. And it shows.
Yeah. I think a Jayco was their best selling EV of the month, which it's not even a Chinese brand I'm very familiar with. So that's a big one. I will add, speaking of Chinese EVs, for my next lightning round thing, the Lincoln Co. 10 Plus, they just announced charges from 10 to 97% in 10 minutes, or 10 to 80% in 5 minutes and 32 seconds. So it's just nuts. I mean, those are gas fill up numbers, really. And it's basically on charge with, or on par with, Geely megawatt charging. But it's like, okay, now
BYD.
Right. Oh, sorry. BYD. This is Geely's. Sorry. But now it's like, all right, well, they have multiple companies that are pushing this. And I think, number one, it's cool to see that it's not all reliant on one tech leader, the way that, you know, for the first long time, it felt like all of our EV trajectory was based on Tesla. But it's also interesting because China's where like the battery swapping stations have taken off. And I had, a friend that worked at a startup here that was working on that. And, you know, when I told them what the numbers were on fast charging in China now, it's like, it's really hard to imagine building the infrastructure for a fast battery swap station if you can charge a battery in under 10 minutes. And so that's just a good reminder. Like, we can actually solve all these technical problems. We need to drive down the prices, but like, you don't actually need solid state batteries. You don't need any technology that doesn't exist. You just need better engineering and better infrastructure.
Yeah. And the Lincoln Co., this is a sedan. It has like 100 kilowatt hour battery. So it's not like, it's actually getting like a significant, that 10 to 97 or 10 to 80, like you're getting a good amount of range for that, like hundreds of miles of range. It's pretty amazing. I still do wonder, and I wonder if we'll ever get, I would love to look into this, is like with the now those first BYDs with megawatt charging have been on the road for like a year. Probably need to wait longer than that, but I do wonder what this does. Like, demonstrating it once is great. Doing it like 1,000 times is what you really need to make an EV that makes sense. So we'll see in a couple of years, like, does megawatt charging, or like an average charge of whatever it is, like 500 kilowatts over a charging session. What does that do to your battery?
I don't
think we have that answer yet. My last piece of news, Walmart's EV charging network is growing really fast. It's one of these companies that you see experts point to as like the kind of next wave of EV charging.
Mm-hmm.
Walmart, BP Pulse, Mercedes-Benz, high power charging. There are these like newish players that are really serious. They are pushing forward. They're putting in really high powered stations too, which is great to see. So this is according to federal data spotted by our friends at State of Charge. Walmart now has 31 owned and operated charging stations, up from 10 in November. They used to have like other, you know, third party charging stations. They still have a lot of those, but now they're branching out into like actually doing it themselves.
Yeah.
It has well over 200 plugs, and these are all 400 kilowatt units, which is just, it's just awesome to see. It's just, you know, despite maybe some of the EV sales coming in a little crappy, like EV charging is not slowing down at all.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I think about when I'm looking to get another EV, where I'm like, oh, well, I'm not really concerned about the charging infrastructure right now. I was 2 years ago. I'm not really right now, which means I'm really not going to care in 2 years because all this progress is happening. And I will say, like, you know, it might not be the obvious fit when you first think about it, but a Walmart is, if I can't find one of these newer flagship stations that have built-in amenities or whatever, an Ayana, a Rove, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a Walmart is a place that I will, if I see that an EV charger is in a Walmart parking lot, I will go there because I know there will be a bathroom, there will be a variety of food options, and like that's more than you get at a lot of places. And just having clean bathroom. And now if you could, you know, make sure that someone at the Walmart location knows how to reset the chargers, knows how to handle payment issues, you could start actually building this into a real, you know, network. And I think, all of these business models are going to be figured out. The technology isn't the problem right now for charging infrastructure. It's just figuring out, like, what is a good charging stop look like? Who is actually using this? And I think this is just an example of, like, this company took an early pilot on it, learned a lot, and now they're coming back and doing it their own way better. And I'm excited to see how that goes.
Yeah, and I'll add, so these are, is hardware from Alpitronic or ABB, and they have NACS and CCS every charger, which is like, you know, love the idea of not having to use an adapter. So I imagine that's probably going to be more of the norm.
Cool.
Alrighty. Well, thanks for listening to the Plugged In podcast from Inside EVs. We'll be back next Friday. Today's show was produced by Michael Perkins and is brought to you by the Motorsport Network. Make sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe to the Inside EVs YouTube channel, and check out all our latest coverage at InsideEVs.com. See you next time.
Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.